Welcome to Brain and Avat. We are delighted to be joined by Spencer Case. Spencer has just co-authored a book with Matt Lutz called Is Morality Real? And it's part of the Little Debates About Big Questions series. Spencer, would you like to start with a thought experiment?
Yes, thank you, Mark and Jason, for having me back on. So Descartes, in the beginning of Meditations, imagines himself being deceived by an evil demon that can give him false sensory impressions. And then the rest of the Meditations is his sort of working his way out of the skeptical position that he's put himself in. I think of him as sort of a philosophical escape artist where he, you know, he ties himself up, but he makes sure that he's got, you know, just enough room to pick the locks and escape by the narrowest margin. You know, he could have made the demon slightly stronger and give him any kind of clear and distinct impression, and then he could not have gotten out of it. But he manages to get out of it, at least he claims to, and his first move is to say that, well, he knows that he can't be deceived about his own existence. In order to be deceived, in order to doubt, he has to exist. So there's this one sort of point of complete certainty. And I want to consider whether there are any other points of certainty like that, that relate to the question that we're talking about today, the reality of morality. And I want to ask whether it's possible that we could be completely deceived about whether we have any reasons for anything at all, any reasons to do anything, any reasons to think anything, any reasons to feel a certain emotion rather than another, and including any reason to just suspend judgment, because that's still a reason. Even if you realize you don't have enough evidence to decide to believe one thing or another, that seems like a reason to suspend judgment about a question. And I want to submit that it's very hard to see how we could think of ourselves as having no reasons apply to us whatsoever. It could be the case that there's just nothing consequential going on for us at the moment, but we can always imagine ourselves in circumstances where we would have reasons. We can always imagine thinking that we have reasons to believe one thing or another, even if right now we don't have sufficient evidence or sufficient resources of investigation to decide what we should believe. I think this is important because a lot of people who are skeptical about morality are willing to grant that there are reasons of other kinds. They're willing to grant that there are reasons of self-interest, typically, and they're typically willing to grant that there are reasons to believe things and reasons to suspend judgment about things. In fact, this is sort of implied in the entire argument about whether we should accept moral realism or not. And they think that that's sort of an innocent sort of concession to make because there's a massive gap between moral reasons and other kinds of reasons. But I think there's a lot going on in that first step. Once we admit that there are reasons that count in favor of our actions and count in favor of forming certain beliefs over others, I think that takes us quite a long way to establishing moral realism.
So wouldn't your opponent, the moral anti-realist, just say two things? The one would be, well, moral reasons are categorically different from other kinds of reasons. And so even if we think there's good evidence for there being reasons for certain types of actions, so let's say there's reasons to suspend judgment in a certain case or reasons to believe in another case, those aren't the same kinds of things as reasons to act in a certain way where those reasons suggest that acting in that way is moral. Aren't moral reasons just different from other types of reasons? And aren't moral reasons adding something that those other types of reasons don't have? So they're adding a should of a more forceful kind. You should perform this action because it's the moral action to do. Seems more imperative than you should believe this because there's good evidence for it. It seems like the normativity associated is much, much greater. And so because of that, they could draw the line and say, well, I'm happy with smaller amounts of normativity, but not larger amounts. So that's the first thing they could say. And then the second thing they could say is something like, well, isn't the force of the evil demon case that we, it's not that we can imagine a situation where we do have reasons for thinking that there is something true. It's that there are situations where we don't have any reasons. So they're trying to point out the extreme case, the limiting case. And I can imagine a limiting case where we don't have any reasons for anything. It would be a case where, for example, we are not free. So we think that we have free will, which is why we think that when we engage in actions, that those actions are valuable and are ours and are freely ours. But suppose it turned out that we were not free. We were not free agents. It seems then that our actions have less value. For example, it wouldn't make a lot of sense to say, I performed this action and I'm praiseworthy for doing so, even though I was not free in doing so. That seems like a contradiction. And so they could point out those kind of situations and say, well, in those situations, we don't actually have any reasons for doing anything, believing anything. Again, in those situations, you might have certain beliefs, and it seems that we have reasons for holding those beliefs, but actually those reasons didn't form freely. Maybe they have some sort of claim about how even epistemic reasons, if they're implanted in your brain in the wrong kind of way and it's not through your normal sensory inputs, that those reasons are not good reasons for believing things. So they would just try and construct scenarios where, just like in the evil demon case, where the evil demon makes you believe that you're in a physical world, but you're not actually. In those kind of cases, those limiting cases, there aren't actually reasons for doing or believing anything.
So let me take the second one first. In the book, we don't really say much or maybe even anything at all about free will. We treat the realism, anti-realism debate as orthogonal to the free will debate. And I know there are people who think that they intersect and interact, those debates. But I think I'm of the opinion that if it turns out that we have no free will, that should just cause us to revise our idea of what it is to have a reason to do something. So I want to say that if it turns out that we don't have free will, or libertarian free will at least, I'd have to think about whether or not this is true of compatibilism. I think it's true even if we don't have compatibilistic free will. Like, it's hard determinism is true. I still want to say, like, we can definitely make sense of saying, well, that person should have rescued the drowning child. I should not put my hand on the stove because it's hot. I think that could all be cashed out in deterministic terms that are satisfactory enough. Maybe there's some revision of our concepts that would be going on there. But it doesn't seem to me that it's a kind of revision that would be error theoretic. So I guess that's what I'm inclined to say about the free will stuff, although I know there are people who disagree with me about that. As for the first question, this is what people tend to say. They want to say that moral reasons are different than other kinds of reasons. And so there are indeed good grounds to be skeptics about morality, but not other kinds of reasons. Typically, the feature that is pointed to is categoricity, or independence of one's own desire. So I don't think it has to do with a stronger form of normativity. In my view, there's just one kind of ought, really. I don't think that there is any radical pluralism about the different kinds of ought that apply to us. They're just different circumstances that give different reasons for different things, but the odd, I think, is the same. It just has different. There's different content to why it is that we ought to do something. So I think a reason of self-interest can be really, really, really forceful. Like, you really shouldn't, you know, do something that's going to cost you like a limb or something like that. I don't think that there's any stark difference then between reasons of self-interest and morality in terms of that. Now, this one about desire independence is one that is a little harder to get around, but I still think that if we're thinking carefully about this, Are other types of reasons all desire dependent? If you think that, I mean, and some people will say this, but it definitely constrains what you're allowed to say, what you're able to say in terms of what your theory of prudential reason is, and in terms of what your theory of epistemic reason is. I think it's quite awkward to try to insist that all of this can be explained in terms of an agent's desires. It seems to me that epistemic reasons are not like this. So there are certain kinds of reasons that the entire category of reason becomes moot for somebody who just doesn't care about it. So think about financial reasons. If I take an oath of poverty, then you could say, I have a financial reason to do something. And I could say, well, there's a sense in which that's true. But, you know, I've renounced the entire domain of reason. It doesn't apply to me. I don't care about its object. In my mind, it doesn't make sense to say that or something similar to that about epistemic reasons. So you shouldn't be, you know, delving into all these weird conspiracy theories on the internet and just searching for confirming evidence and then forming your beliefs that way. You shouldn't be doing that. I can't say, but you see, I just don't care about forming my beliefs in a reasonable way. That doesn't seem like the first one of those. The first one is compatible with an agent being rational. You could have, it seems, good reasons not to take financial reasons seriously in a certain way. But I think if you're alienated in that way from epistemic reasons, it just doesn't seem to be the same. So I think epistemic reasons are just constitutive of what it is to be a rational person in a way that wouldn't be true of like financial reasons. And so I think there's some desire independence there. And I think there is about well-being too, right? Like I think if I simply don't care about my future well-being, that doesn't mean that I don't have any reason to care about it, right? It seems like I prudentially ought to care about whether I'm going to be suffering terribly because of this decision I'm about to make, even if I don't care or I care about it only very little. And so that leads me to think, well, what really is the difference between my future self and another person who could be suffering right here in front of me? In either case, I could either care about them or not. And in either case, I want to say, yeah, I've got reasons to care about the well-being of my future self and this other person.
So it seems like there's a distinction between if-then type statements. So if you care about your financial well-being, then you ought to take the following, you know, steps, like saving X amount per month, versus categorical imperatives where you say, regardless of whatever you personally believe or what your interests are, you must do this thing. So let's return back to the epistemic case. It seems like you could say, if you want to know what's true, then one way to do that is to weigh up the evidence in a fair-minded way, and not to engage in, you know, self-confirming conspiracy theory searches. If you don't care what's true, well, then that's not the path you ought to take. It seems like you can cash it out in that manner. In terms of self-interest, you could say, if you care about, you know, living to a ripe old age, well, then you ought to eat a healthy diet and you ought to exercise. If you don't, well, then you ought not to. It seems that the moral case says that there is some fact of the matter. There is some thing that is necessarily wrong in all possible worlds. And that's the hard thing to prove. Whereas in the epistemic case or the prudential case, we can point at a fact. We can say, you do hold this interest. It is a fact that you have this desire. It is a fact that these things will lead to the, you know, that desire being met. In the moral case, it starts to get very contentious. So it's clearly the case that there's widespread intuitions about certain kinds of behavior being wrong. But is that pointing at a social consensus? There were widespread intuitions about all sorts of things over time. People intuitively thought that gay marriage was wrong, that owning slaves was fine. These things were widely held. And then people changed their minds. So you could take the view that morality really is some kind of social technology which we invent because it's useful for our other ends. Or you could say, no, it's tracking some actual real-world fact. And then I want to know, where's that fact? How do I touch it or taste it?
you could characterize these other kinds of oughts, non-moral oughts, as being just sort of conditional. If you care about them, then you've got a reason to do them. I don't think that those oughts can be characterized in those terms in a way that's satisfactory. To a certain degree, they can. There are a range of lives that are worth living. Like, the longest life is not necessarily the best life. So I could imagine people choosing career paths that are dangerous, that would have a lower life expectancy, but it might still be the right decision overall, you know? But a person's desires are certainly relevant to that. But I would push back on the claim that they are exhaustive. So I think there might be some things that are, that would be bad for you regardless of your present desire, right? And I would want to say that about knowledge too. I mean, you could say, yeah, it's true. Yeah. Like there are certain things, like there's certain subjects that interest me and I study them and I seek knowledge about them because I want to have knowledge about those things. And there are other things that I think are worthy of learning about that I don't invest the same amount of time into. So there's a sense in which my desires are shaping, what I learn about, but I wouldn't want to say that is exhaustive. So if I'm engaging in just atrociously bad reasoning and self-deceptive practices, to say, well, I simply don't care about knowledge, I think somebody should come back and say, well, you should, or at least you should care about avoiding certain kinds of ignorance that are in your power to avoid, apparently in your power to avoid. So I'm inclined to say that. And so if it turns out that these other kinds of reasons aren't really just completely conditional, they're partly conditional, but partly not conditional, then the gap between moral reasons and these other kinds of reasons seems smaller, and there's a less of a wedge that the skeptic can place between them.
So in the first case, I can point at all of these things that we can embrace in the world, but when you say there is some moral fact of the matter, maybe you can point at other underlying phenomena. You can say, if you kill someone, that person's interests are going to be set back, you know, but to say that you can derive an ought from an is. So it is the case that their interests will be set back, to say, I ought not to do it because of that normative realm. Where does that fact come from?
So Hume had this famous line in the treatise, Treatise of Human Nature, I believe is where he has this, where he says that he often reads these authors who are making all of these is statements, and then they're suddenly making ought statements. And well, there's one thing to say something is something, another to say you ought to do something. And his complaint was that they tend to go really quickly to one to another. But somehow, like in the 20th century, Hume's philosophical descendants treated this as like an iron law, that is are one kind of thing and oughts are another, and like never the twain shall meet or something like that. Whereas if you're a moral realist, by the way, I think I should define that. I've been talking for a while. I haven't said what that is. So a moral realist thinks that moral statements like the transatlantic slave trade is morally wrong. He thinks that those are meaningful. They're at least meaningful, like they can be true or false. Some of them are true, and their truth is not determined or dependent upon social convention or human desire, be it individual or collective. So that's what I mean by moral realist. So the idea that there are objective moral truths. So moral facts are not like currency facts. Currency facts, like if everybody in the world decided that the US dollar was worthless, it would in fact not be money anymore. It would be worthless economically because no one would trade anything for it. But if everyone in the world, including, you know, people who were being enslaved, thought that slavery was a just institution, I claim that wouldn't make it so. It would still be wrong. So that's moral realism. And so, okay, so how do we pass from the is's of people's interests to the oughts of of you shouldn't violate those interests. Notice that I think even in the word interest, there's a little bit of an ought in there, you know. So to say that something is someone's interest, I think implies that there's some sort of reason to care about it. And I think we have no trouble passing from the is, the supposed is, to the ought in the individual interest case, right? Like, nobody seems all that baffled about such and such is in your interest, Spencer, but that you ought to pursue your interests. We don't seem to be so perplexed about this. And I think there's no reason for us to be treating morality as somehow, you know, fundamentally different or more mysterious than it is. I think this is of a piece with other reasons that we talk about.
What I want to get back to is this idea that there's just one type of ought. That strikes me as too strong or too... I understand if you want to say that there's not huge differences between the types of oughts and that if you believe in one type of ought, you should believe in the others. But it strikes me as too strong to say that there's just one type. So I'm going to give you some cases and you tell me if these are all the same type of ought. You should really try the chocolate cake. It's delicious. That claim. Versus you shouldn't mow down a busload of school children with an AK-47. Versus you should place a napkin on your lap when you eat. They all seem very different to me. They have very different force behind them. They seem categorically different, not just differences of degree. It's strange to me to think that the ought of taste versus the ought of morality versus the ought of etiquette are the same type of ought.
I assume when you give the example of you ought not mow down a bus full of school children with an AK-47, it's not because another kind of weapon would be more effective. I assume that's not what you're getting at. Okay, it's not. So I want to say first, yes, I take the stronger position here. Moral realism doesn't require me to say that there's only one kind of ought. You know, this goes beyond what I argue in the book. And I don't think I've committed to this in print anywhere, but it is my position. And so let me go ahead and defend it anyway. So I think that the all things considered ought is basic, and any other kind of ought that we talk about that is worth considering is sort of constructed out of that. So I think like in the chocolate cake case, you ought to try the chocolate cake. Like all things considered to do in this situation, this is what you should do. Now, if this is a case in which there's a child drowning like in front of me, then I should rescue the child and you know, eat the cake later, or even sacrifice the cake eating opportunity to save the child. But I'm assuming that in the context of ordinary conversation, that isn't going to be a case like this. And so right now, the best thing you can do is to have the cake. So I'm assuming that is how that would be analyzed. And as for etiquette, I get this is like a pet peeve of mine, people treating the etiquette ought as being like a different kind of ought than the moral ought. But I just think, no, like this is etiquette is just, well, I'll say in not in deviant cases, we can think of the deviant cases too. And then there might be something going wrong in those, but in ordinary cases, etiquette is just morality writ small, right? So politeness is showing respect for people and being a good person within a particular cultural context with regard to things that are small. I don't think of etiquette as some free floating, self-contained system of odds. I think it's like, you know, moral odds with regard to small things. So like the napkin thing, It's nice not to get crumbs all over someone's floor or what have you. It's not a huge deal, but you probably have some all things considered reason to do it. Now you might get these other cases where, you know, you ought to, treat your slaves in a certain like way in a kind of etiquette that is embedded in a highly hierarchical society, that we would find to be deeply unjust. And in that kind of case, I would want to say that the etiquette ought is actually false in that case. Like, you actually shouldn't. You have a false belief if you think that's what good etiquette would be. So that's what I'm inclined to say about those cases.
So it seems to me that etiquette and morality could overlap. As you say, some etiquette norms are about expressions of politeness. And if you think you've got a moral duty to be polite, then you should abide by the etiquette norm. So in Japan, maybe you should bow instead of shaking hands, and that's a way of doing a moral thing. And there are other times where it seems that it's just an arbitrary convention. So what size of fork you use, whether you wear white after Labor Day, there's just a whole bunch of stuff that has nothing to do with respect for others. It's just about abiding by a certain convention that's been crystallized. Now, what the moral anti-realist is going to say is, well, etiquette and morality are very similar. They're just about obeying conventions. And so it is the case that people sincerely believe that there are these moral norms out there and that there will be consequences for breaching them. You might get punished, people might attack you, but all that stuff's just social convention. We could just understand how humans behave without any recourse to moral language. So we can just say people have this capacity to suffer. If you cause them to suffer, people might retaliate and cause you to suffer. So if you care about your prudential interests, you have some reason not to do it. But to say that it's somehow wrong, that you've broken some law of the universe to go and, stick the needle in the baby's eye, that's just an imagined thing. There's no moral fact anywhere. There's just other reasons why you ought not to do it. They're not moral reasons. They could always be cashed out in terms of self-interest, and they could always be cashed out in terms of genuine facts in the world. And it might very well be useful if we could just pretend that these things existed. We would get some kind of, society cooperates better. It might be in our mutual self-interests to, abide by these customs. And maybe the content of the customs matters sometimes, but not so much otherwise. We could cooperate in like a sports game where the rules are entirely arbitrary. You can make up whatever sports game rules we want. But we think, for the sense of the cohesion of the teams, you should abide by the rules if what you care about is cohesion in the sport. If you don't care about cohesion in the sport, then you should disobey all the rules. And these things can always be cashed out in terms of, conditional imperatives. What I think you're going to struggle with is, how do you give me this universal, you must always do this in all cases, imperative? The moral skeptic will always just deny that there is some moral fact that compels them to do this.
As far as, some etiquette seems like it isn't about politeness and isn't about morality at all, like what kind of fork you should use with this salad. Well, there are some sort of conventions of orderliness that help things go more smoothly and maybe contribute to well-being in a small way. And then there are others that are simply there as a way of, condescension, showing how wealthy and sophisticated you are or something like that, a display of status that might have no value or even negative value. And maybe being super concerned about what forks to use falls in that category, in which case I would say that's not a real reason. It's not a real reason. You can come up with systems of norms that people talk about as reasons, some of which I think are not actual reasons. So if it falls into that category, I'd say we're not talking about actual reasons. Now, the convention case, the morality as convention case, is interesting because I think there are actually a couple of different views you can tease out of this. I'd say different things to them. So one is a kind of error theory. So there is no morality. There are just these conventions that are there to promote our self-interest. But there's another view that is in the ballpark. It's another form of anti-realism because it denies that morality is objective, but it still treats morality as an existing thing and maybe something quite important, according to which morality consists of a series of like agreements or contracts or something like that with other people to each do things that will promote our collective self-interest. And maybe it doesn't have this sort of overriding force for the individual, but it still has some status and some standing. And so that, I think, is it wouldn't be nihilism. It has morality in the picture, but it doesn't make it totally objective. So I think those two things are just importantly different views. I'm sorry, could I kick it back over to you and I'll take it forward from there.
I'm curious now about some of the reasons why someone might think that morality isn't real. So one of them would be disagreement. So you talked about morality consisting in contracts between people, or an error theory that it's just a set of conventions. I know that you don't hold either of those positions, but just sort of expanding on those positions, someone could say, well, the contracts that we all hold are very different. If you go from society to society, the contracts are very different. The conventions are very different. Why think that there's one thing, one objective thing called morality? And here's a stronger version of it. So that initial version is often used to support a position called moral relativism, that morality is relative to society. It still exists in some way, but it's relative to society. There's no objective moral facts that exist across societies, but there are moral facts within societies. That's the moral relativist claim. But I think there's a stronger version of it, which is that, well, have a look at the moral theories that seem to hold that morality is objective, that take this view. You've got utilitarians, you've got deontologists, you've got consequentialists, you've got virtue ethicists. They all seem to disagree on quite important claims. There are these classic objections to utilitarians. Utilitarians, for example, seem to be committed to views like you should harvest the organs of a healthy person to save many, or it's fine to have a Colosseum where you throw someone in with the gladiator, or throw the gladiator in, the gladiator suffers and everyone has a great time. And so the great time of this huge audience outweighs the suffering of the gladiator or the person the gladiator is harming. It seems like those kind of consequences are totally anathema to the other moral theories, right? To the virtue ethicist, to the deontologist. It seems like there's very big differences in what those moral theories say you should do in situations. Seeing that there's so much disagreement, not just between cultures, but even within one culture, within the Western view on morality, why think that there is one morality? And just as an analogy to this, one of the guests we've had on our show, who was previously in the Islam atheism debate, Aaron Fasser, he holds this view about religion, religions disagreeing. He talks about doxastic disagreement as being a reason for thinking that God doesn't exist. So he thinks that because religions generally disagree about the nature of God, why not think that actually God doesn't exist at all? Because if there was a God, we would think that the religions would pretty much agree on what God is and how you should worship God. Similarly, if morality was objective, was real, wouldn't we expect to see general agreement, not just across cultures, but across moral theories in Western culture?
I think those things are importantly different. And you're right, this gets into some really important issues. I want to concede that disagreement is some evidence in favor of moral anti-realism. I don't think it's decisive, but I think it's fair to say that this is a basis for skepticism to some degree. But I think it's a reason that the realist can handle and can overcome. So for the cross-cultural stuff, I think that one is easier to answer than the philosophical one. So the cross-cultural stuff, it turns out to be very difficult to isolate the proper form of fundamental moral disagreement that's supposed to cause the realist a problem here. Because it turns out that moral beliefs tend to be packaged with all of these other beliefs. Like people believe, people in certain cultures seem obsessed with revenge and stuff, but that's bound up with the belief in evil spirits and karma and stuff, various sorts of magic and hexes. And if you believe in that stuff, that might actually be relevant to how you should behave to other people. And it might actually have some radical consequences. So like I would behave differently if I thought that people were constantly casting hexes on me and stuff like that. So the other thing is, you don't really, it's really difficult to say where a culture ends and another culture begins. So a lot of interest in like cultural relativism began with anthropology in the mid 20th century, where they were studying very isolated societies in New Guinea that had, and that had radically different beliefs and practices than Westerners do. But like in New Guinea, like a someone in a village there would not know somebody like a different village, like a few miles away, because it's such rugged terrain. And so people got in the habit of thinking of cultures as these sort of sealed off units, rather than this is actually kind of an unusual situation. Usually cultures are interacting with one another, and they're constantly changing their own views. And, you know, it's hard to think of, you know, just a system of cultural norms or whatever. So I think it was the philosopher Richard Brandt who went and spent a few years on a Hopi Indian reservation in Arizona, or maybe it was a few months rather. And he wrote this book, Hopi Ethics, that's often cited as evidence of fundamental moral disagreement because of the way some of the children would treat animals in that society. But if you look, actually read the book and not just the excerpts of it that are cited, it looks like there's actually quite a lot of disagreement and inconsistencies in how that society feels about animals. And that's true of like white Westerners too. So the situation about different cultures turns out to be very messy, and it's hard to isolate the kind of really troubling disagreement. Now, the philosophical one, I think, is more forceful, because here we have people who apparently are like really giving it their all, all of their attention, and they're still arriving at apparently intractable disagreement over these questions. But I want to point out a few things. One, you see this with other philosophical questions too, like about whether God exists, and there must be an answer to that, right? There must be an answer to that. So so that would just be relevant to whether or not there is something there to be like there's an objective question here to be answered. So I think the disagreement is certainly compatible with saying yes. Does it lead us to answer that question negatively, though, as in, as Aaron says about the God case? Well, in the God case, you would expect, I mean, the atheist argument there is that you would expect an almighty God to make himself, to have the power and the motive to make himself known to people. I don't see why we should say that about moral facts. Like, there could be a moral structure of the universe, but it's not going to have all the attributes of God. And, you know, it's up to us very imperfectly formed humans to try to grope our way to the truth here. So I don't think it raises the same kind of problem.
Suppose the moral structure of the universe was such that it was inaccessible by humans. Suppose that we couldn't access it. So we wouldn't know in any given case whether an action is right or wrong. Do you really think that that moral structure would have the kind of importance or value that we would say it has in a case where the moral structure was very accessible?
So as I defined realism, it is compatible with moral skepticism. It's compatible with there being objective truths and we don't know what they are. In a way, that is a more terrifying possibility, that there are moral truths and we're completely in the dark about them. So moral realists are going to reject moral skepticism, even if they don't consider it to be a fundamental part of defining the realist position. So it is, but the realist does have to say that I think that there's at least the possibility that we could be radically wrong about the way morality is. It seems like that's a possibility we have to be open to, unsettling though it is. In as much as morality, though, just by its nature concerns evaluating agents like ourselves, if that's part of the nature of morality, then you might think that that places some limit on the distance from it could be from us in some way. Like, if it turn like it just seems like maybe morality is just conceptually, like, its essence is to be concerned with things such as good intentions, bad intentions, you know, mens rea, this kind of stuff. That there, so there might be some hard limit on how alienated we can be from the moral truth, but I don't really know the answer to that.
It just seems if there wasn't a limit, we would never be praiseworthy or blameworthy for our actions. So, you know, if morality could be in its own realm that's totally inaccessible to us, that we could never know, then it seems like morality is no different from some sort of very sophisticated calculus or algebra that humans could never realize. You know, it accurately describes the world. It describes our actions. You know, perhaps there's some very, very sophisticated form of quantum physics that we would never think of, or some even more complex form of physics than quantum physics that humans just cannot comprehend, and our AI and our minds would just never get there. And we'd think, okay, yes, that correctly describes the world, but, you know, we would not be praiseworthy or blameworthy for not acting in accordance with that, or it wouldn't hold any value in our daily lives. It's just sort of background stuff, background noise in the universe. You know, if what you're saying is that your version of realism implies that there could be a morality like that, then you're at least opening up the door to the skeptic saying, well, fine, morality is real, but it's so different from the kind of thing that we're debating that, for all intents and purposes, the thing that we're debating, you're admitting, could be unreal.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't want to go quite that far. So let me clarify. So I could imagine that there is some advanced alien species out there that could come to Earth and explain to us how a lot of our practices are radically wrong and how they were on a path of progress that they've just continued much more into the future than we have. So they can just see a lot farther than we can. But it would have to ultimately be explainable to us. I think morality concerns ought. It concerns what we ought to do. And I think there's an ought implies can component just baked into the cake. Like, if we could not access these truths, then they could not be action guiding. And that seems like that just makes it not the kind of thing that I'm talking about. So I do think there's a hard limit on how alienated from morality we could be, but we could still be very, very radically wrong.
So it seems like there's two competing hypotheses for why people hold moral beliefs. So the one is that we're like scientists who are discovering things. So like we're able to discover various facts about the world, find out that the world is not flat, that it's geode-shaped, you know, to explore space. We could be like moral scientists. So we make progress over time because we've discovered more and more moral truths. So we've expanded the net of, you know, consideration from, let's say, ourselves, our family, our tribe, to, you know, humanity, to maybe all sentient beings, because we're engaged in a scientific endeavor. The other line is to say, no, there are no moral facts at all. The reason why we hold moral beliefs is entirely because of evolutionary imperatives that make it in our ongoing interest to hold these moral beliefs, or that they come through various social pressures or various cultural pressures, but there is no scientific endeavor here. The evolutionary account can explain why we hold a whole bunch of false beliefs. So, you know, people believe in magic, people pattern recognize, they believe in gods. None of that stuff tracks truth, but there's good evolutionary explanations for why people hold those supernatural beliefs. So why not think that? If there's something non-natural about morality, we can't like hold it or grasp it in the way we can about other facts, why not put it in the rest of the supernatural bucket, along with witchcraft and, you know, magical genies and things?
All right. So I want to say a couple things about the book, because Matt Lutz and I do discuss the naturalism, non-naturalism distinction. And I ultimately identify myself as a non-naturalist, but I sort of feel boxed into that a bit. This is like in the first part of the book, we're going over the various positions and fundamental terms, and the naturalism, non-naturalism distinction is, looms large in the literature here. But I have to say, Matt feels more strongly about how that line should be drawn than I do. And the more I've thought about it, the less I'm sure I feel strongly about calling myself a non-naturalist, because I'm less and less sure, the more I think of it, I'm less and less sure of what a natural property is. There are different ways philosophers have drawn this line. So I don't know. I don't know whether I'd call myself a non-naturalist anymore, even though I commit to it in the book. But it's not because I want to call myself a naturalist. It's just because I'm not sure there's a really important distinction here. So I want to say that. And I also want to say that this evolutionary debunking argument that you're pushing is, I think, one of the stronger arguments in the anti-realist arsenal. And Matt pushes it very hard. And I try to resist it. So one thing I want to say about this is, why doesn't the evolutionary debunking argument overgeneralize? This is just a common kind of move for against any kind of skepticism that isn't global. So why doesn't your skepticism commit us to stronger skepticism? So we could say, no, we could say the same thing about prudential interest or self-interest. You, Jason, you think that certain things are good for you and certain things are bad for you, I'm assuming. Here's a hypothesis. You just think that because evolution is, you know, working its powers on you, and these tendencies are supposed to, in most people, promote reproduction and that sort of thing. So you could explain, I think, away even basic self-interest as just an artifact of evolution. But I think we're likely to have the reaction that that kind of a debunking just isn't very plausible. Like I have my hand on the hot stove. It hurts. I'm definitely being harmed by this. This is bad for me. Sure, there are reasons that I was evolved to feel this way that we could talk about, but it doesn't make me doubt that what I'm experiencing really is bad for me. And likewise, I want to say that the evolutionary debunking stuff, sure, you know, we're created as social creatures. There are good evolutionary reasons where we are social creatures, but I want to say that that doesn't give me actual reason to doubt that certain things really are wrong. And in fact, I want to even go further and say that a lot of these evolutionary debunking, like, they don't stop and think, like, well, if evolution has its fingerprints really heavily on particular moral beliefs, it is kind of puzzling that we don't have certain moral beliefs. Like, it is kind of puzzling that most people don't seem to think that not having children is severely morally wrong. I mean, you can be a pronatalist and argue that, but it's not like intuitive to people. And it's also interesting how we can have very, very strong moral intuitions about things that don't even seem all that useful for promoting our genes. So an example I give in the book is, we can have science fiction. There's good science fiction that shows that we can have empathy towards aliens and recognize that they have like extraterrestrials, that they would have certain rights and that it would be wrong to treat them in certain ways. Even though they, you know, by hypothesis, they share none of our genes. And of course, you could give an evolutionary explanation of this, but it seems not hard to give evolutionary explanations of mental states. It seems like any mental state you could have, I could say that, well, it's because of evolution, but that doesn't always make us skeptical about it, you know? So I'm underwhelmed by the evolutionary debunking kind of stuff, ultimately. If you look really closely at it, I don't think it's compelling.
So your skeptic might say something like this: why do we think that any given moral claim is true? So it's wrong to torture innocent children. Why is that true? Why is that claim true? You might say, well, there's two possible reasons. The one is that there is some overriding or overarching moral principle that shows us why it's wrong to torture innocent children, some consequentialist or some deontological or virtue ethicist principle, or some principle of care, whatever it is. But really, that's not what's going on a daily basis in people's heads. So when you ask the average person on the street, why is it wrong to torture an innocent child, they'll say, well, it's obviously wrong. You don't need a reason. It's just a gut intuition. And part of the problem with the field of ethics is that these intuitions seem to feature into even the very high-level philosophical debates. So, you know, you ask, well, why is it wrong, even if utilitarianism implies that we should harvest the organs of a healthy person to distribute to many others and save many others, why is that wrong? The opponent of utilitarianism is going to say, well, because intuitively that's wrong. And I know that just as much as I know any other claim. Just as I know that I'm sitting here in my chair, I know that that's wrong. You shouldn't do that. And I don't actually need to give you a principle for why that's wrong. It's wrong. I can give you a principle, but at the end of the day, when you question that principle, you're going to be using your intuitions too. And it seems like a battle of intuitions. And there's a few problems with that. The one is, why think that intuitions provide evidence for something to be true? And the second one is, what do we do when we have competing intuitions, which seems to happen a lot in the literature? It seems to happen frequently in the ethics literature that people just have competing intuitions. They don't share the same views of the world.
So I think that it's a bit of an overstatement. I'm not a consequentialist myself. Sometimes I find myself tempted in that direction, but I wouldn't call myself a consequentialist. But I do think that the deontologist is probably overstating things if he says, I know that the utilitarian has the wrong answer to that case as much as I know anything else, or even as much as I know any other moral claim, because it's a weird kind of case. And I think on reflection, in those cases, you know, about which the different theories disagree, we should have a lower credence. And I think we generally do. I think we generally do have lower credences about these weird sorts of cases. There's also quite a lot of agreement. You know, there's quite a lot of agreement. There's a reason that the kind of cases that we're arguing about are, you know, can you take the organs from one innocent person, kill that person, and then like save a greater number? That sort of situation doesn't arise very often. And we're not debating about like, well, let's see, the Holocaust, yay or nay, what's your intuition? Like, we're not arguing about that stuff. There's certain things, I think, that are just presupposed as givens. And if disagreement is evidence for anti-realism, why can't agreement be some evidence of convergence on a truth? So that's one thing I want to say. Hold on a second.
Yeah, so why do intuitions provide evidence at all?
So I guess really to sharpen it, it would be, I think, why do synthetic a priori intuitions provide evidence? So the conceptual ones, the ones about conceptual truths, it's like if it's part of language or concepts, it's not that hard to see how we have knowledge of them. It's the synthetic a priori ones that are it's really difficult to explain. Like there are these abstract truths that apparently do not causally influence the world, and yet somehow I'm grasping it with my mind, which is somehow related to my brain. Like, what's the causal process here? So I admit that this is a really difficult question, and I don't have a knockdown answer to it. There, I do give a number of different things people have suggested. But let me explain how I think this dialectic should work, what the realist should say to this. So number one, very, very often, and I can take this bit as like my closing argument for the book. So very often, moral anti-realists who are skeptical that we have this kind of intuition-based knowledge are themselves relying on similar knowledge along the way. So I think my interlocutor in the book, Matt, does this when he gives this this argument for skepticism that presupposes some things about knowledge that do not seem to me to be just conceptual truths. It seems like this is a truth. This is some abstract truth about knowledge that he has. How does he have that? I think it's the same way I have moral knowledge. So one, there's the kind of dialectical move that we might also be in the same camp here. The second thing I want to say is there are some realists who say, okay, maybe we don't have synthetic a priori knowledge. Maybe it turns out that the fundamental knowledge is analytic, right? So Sharon Rolette says this, and she is a hedonic utilitarian. I recommend checking out her book, The Feeling of Value. Very, very underrated ethicist. And she gives a very good defense of hedonic utilitarianism, where she thinks it's just a matter of definition that pleasure is good. And so she defends that view pretty effectively. So here is what I want to say to the realist who, or the kind of anti-realist who is willing to concede that we have knowledge of other sorts of reasons besides moral reasons. So Matt is in this boat. So he thinks that we have knowledge about like prudential value and what's good for us that isn't, he thinks we have this kind of knowledge, and he thinks that it's just sort of an analytic claim. That is to say that something is good for me is just to say that I have the right sort of mental state, like toward it, like the right sort of pro attitude. So I want to say this. So one, the kind of account he gives of prudential reasons is pretty complicated, and I find it doubtful that anything like it could plausibly be derived from just concepts, that it could plausibly be analytic. If it's not analytic, that we have synthetic a priori knowledge about prudential reason, then we could have it with moral reason too. But the other horn is to say, let's just concede that we don't have synthetic a priori knowledge about any of this stuff, and that what you say about prudential reasons and what's in my interest, that's just analytic. That's a very, very complicated claim about what it means for something to be in one's interest. If we say that, I think the realist can say something similar. Why couldn't the realist say, well, for something to be moral just means for it to be in the interest of overall long-run utility? Now, it doesn't seem to be. If you just look at, it seems like, because I could consistently deny that morality is utilitarian. But if it turns out that some of these claims are really, really complicated, disguised conceptual claims, and they don't reveal this at the surface of just looking at them, then I don't see why that couldn't be the case. So I think either my opponent really has this kind of knowledge anyway, or they don't, but they're relying on something that I could rely on to say, well, maybe I have moral knowledge that way. So that, I think, is my closing argument.